As I got another rhyme, another rhythm for y'all to listen. I'm never quitting on my mission. I'ma roll with what I'm giving. Got some ambition, this new addition, filling positions. Looking at the void in myself and feeling what's missing. Better watch the way you're going. Better go in the right direction. In the moment, you stressing, but you gon' be counting blessings. And I know that for certain. Keep on working, open curtains. Haters swerving, cause they ain't ready for your final version. Whoa. I'm never gon' give up. Fall down, I just gotta get up, yeah. Cause this is my road.
You're listening to the Tom Ficklin Show on WNHHLP 103.5 FM, your home for community radio.
Salutations, Connecticut. Thank you, 103.5 FM New Haven, Tom Ficklin and Harry and New Haven Independent for this time on the air. Thank you. Salutations to all those in New Haven, all over Connecticut, and all over the nation, because people follow us all over the nation at this point. And I'm happy to be here today. And today, I have a really special guest with us, Dr. Rachel Gabrielle, who is a professor of literacy at UConn, written several books, over 50 peer-reviewed articles, and she has something to say about stuff, and we'll talk about that today. But I'd like to begin with an interesting quote from Jonathan Kozol, who in Shame of a Nation, he said, "There is something deeply hypocritical in a society that holds an inner city child, only 8 years old, accountable for her performance on a high-stakes standardized exam, but does not hold the high officials of our government accountable for robbing her of what they gave their own kids 6 or 7 years before." And he wrote that in The Shame of the Nation. I remember that quote because he shared it when he came to Connecticut. He came to Hartford. Everybody was in the house at Hartford when Jonathan Kozol came here. And he shocked us all by taking on a reading program in Hartford, Success for All, and telling us it was a shame. So we're coming to, it's a good piece. I like this idea. And we're going to get into some of this conversation around silver bullets. I'll call them silver bullets. Very expensive silver bullets. The current silver bullet is the science of reading. And everybody's heard about it. And Connecticut's spending over $100 billion. Oh, I forgot. I'm dedicating this show to the 130 to the 140 Wyndham teachers that are about to be laid off. I'm dedicating this show to the 364 teachers and staff that are about to be laid off in Hartford, Connecticut. If I went down those 19 school districts, we probably have a few thousand teachers being threatened to be laid off. While we have $100 million for curriculums, we don't have the money to keep teachers to teach those curriculums. So that's just that other hypothetical thing. But Dr. Gabrielle, tell us a little bit about, you know, your work right now, your passion, and then we'll get into some questions. And welcome to the show, and thank you for being a guest. Listeners, I forgot to also say, Dr. Gabrielle has returned. 3 shows ago, I did a show with 3 Connecticut, well-known Connecticut educators, and we did a show on literacy in Connecticut. So this continues that series, and during that show, I realized every one of my guests had so much to say, so much important information and to the topic, but it's hard to divide it up between me and 3 other people. So I asked them kindly to come back, and they all said they'll come back. And Dr. Gabrielle, thank you for coming back and welcome. Just quickly, a little bit of your passion.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I'm so glad to be back with you on the air. So glad to have another opportunity to have a conversation with you, Dr. Turner. So I am a reading teacher then and now. I was a middle school reading teacher in Washington, D.C. That's where I started my career, and a reading specialist in a couple of other places. And I now am a professor of literacy education at University of Connecticut. And I study policy broadly, and specifically interested in how policy enables and constrains different opportunities for learning. And so I first got interested in policy thinking about teacher evaluation policies, like how do those policies set and limit what counts as good instruction? But of course, because my area is reading, I'm very interested in any state or local policy that has something to do with reading. And right now we've got a whole lot of them. We've got 42 or 46, depending on how we want to categorize these. A lot of the reading policy right now gets folded into other kinds of bills, so it's not its own thing. But in most states of the US over the last 6 years, there's been some kind of policy that is focused on ensuring that schools align with the science of reading. And what's super interesting to me about this is that the science of reading that we talk about in researcher circles, and the science of reading that I see a lot about in social media, and the science of reading that is written into the rules for states and for local districts, don't have a whole lot to do with each other. And then, of course, as you might imagine, the kinds of instruction, content, organization, pedagogy that get written into programs that have science of reading stickers on them, so to speak, also doesn't have a whole lot to do with what the law has asked for, what researchers might suggest, or even what advocates were really hoping they were advocating for when they advocated strongly for policies that would force schools to be in alignment with the science of reading. So we've got a bunch of versions of what counts as good reading instruction running around right now. And I think there's a lot more that folks can agree on when you get to the micro level. But at the macro level, there's a lot of disagreement because it as an issue ends up kind of touching and lighting up other big hot button political issues. The obvious one being book banning, but the not so obvious ones, including everything from whether we should have public schools to begin with, all the way out to whether the US really should be a democracy anymore or not. And so people end up in this conversation for really different reasons, coming from different pathways. It's hard to figure out kind of what grain size people are having the conversation about. And that's why it's easy to trip people up and get a lot of fire into the conversation, but also get a lot of confusion into the conversation. And I think it's interesting for me, and I'm sort of continue to be passionate about thinking and talking with folks about science of reading and how it's behaving in the world, because it's interesting to me at the very micro level, like what does a teacher say at the point of difficulty when a child comes to a word they don't know? And what are we doing in the realm of prevention before intervention even becomes a topic of conversation? But also at the more like meso and macro levels, like what is the role of state's departments of education in supporting public schools in doing good work? And what is the real relationship what does it mean for practice and research to be in right relationship with each other? I think people assume that there's like a simple version of that where research just guides practice, but it's not really in a position to guide practice. So what should that relationship look like? And then all the way to the big political stuff of like, how does the way that we teach first and third graders how to read end up impacting the entire nation? Whether you are a third grader or know a third grader, everybody seems to know a teacher because there are so many of them. But reading ends up being an issue that touches everybody one way or another. So I'm interested in that too.
Excellent. So we'll probably be talking, because some of this stuff to me is, I'm not certain if this definitely doesn't look like best policy to me. This more sounds like, how can we polarize? And then it's funny, Jamal Bowman was in New Haven. So Jamal Bowman is the former middle school principal from the Bronx, and we're old friends, and he's on the education committee in the US. And Jamal Bowman was in New Haven, and we had a discussion, and I was talking about this, and policy said, what you need to do, Jesse, is find out who they buy, who sells them the toilet paper in our school buildings, who sells them the boxes and reams of paper, who sells them the soap, who sells them the cleaners for the floor, who sells them who hooks up the computers, who does all these things. And I'm saying, well, what's that got to do with it? And Jamal Bowman goes, then you should look at the political campaign contributions. Mm-hmm. And so while he was talking toilet paper and soap, we might very well be looking at what kinds of programs are we buying, curriculum programs, what kinds of online programs. And it's interesting to me, Rachel, I'm not certain this could not have come at a worse time in terms of the feds are cutting off $190 billion of COVID funding that paid for the Chromebooks at schools, that paid for the online programs, all of these things they did, especially in our priority school districts. Nobody spent money on adding teachers or adding staff. They spent their money on high-tech program. And now if we're wondering why my teachers in Hartford, why my teachers in Waterbury, why my teachers in Windham are we're talking about layoffs. Right. We might very well be talking about, well, who's going to buy the Chromebooks when they break? Who's gonna pay for this? So all of that stuff. So Jamar Bowman's simple thing was follow the money, and you might find out where the policy comes from. And I'm not certain. I believe part of that. I hope it's not true. But I want to get back to something that where for me is key. Can there be science? Can there be real science when there's such inequity in the system? So Connecticut is, I'd love to say every show, hey, our Supreme Court has decided the state of Connecticut is not responsible for giving every black and brown and special education child in our state an equal and high quality education. We only need to give them a basic access to education. So, so that component, because for me, I view, you know, I'm in literacy just like you. And whenever my department talks about something comes along and I say, first, you have to give me equity. You have to give me equity so I can really judge your policies and your program. So how's your thinking? Can we have science? I mean, we say that we're controlling the variables by saying we included a lot of diversity in there. We did this and we did that. But do we have a science for best practice when some kids get poor practice because we didn't give them the full support and money for it, and others get the whole deal?
Yeah, no.
So share a little bit about that science.
Yeah, I think that you're, we do not currently have a science that has anything to say about reading if equity is the first priority. And there's a couple of reasons for that. There's probably many, but the things that stand out to me are the information that we have from scientific studies is mostly done in communities that are close to universities, in communities that have the bandwidth to partner with universities on studies. And so we're not talking about what we would call alliance districts necessarily. We're not talking about districts that have a lot of balls in the air that they're trying to really balance, a lot of services that they're trying to coordinate for their students. And the populations that we end up studying end up being mostly male and mostly white. So what we know or think we know, put "know" in quotation marks, hard to do on the radio. What we think we know about reading, the science that we think we have, is based on images of white male brains, not only, but predominantly. And it's based on images of upper middle class white male brains, and also studies and test scores and other sort of patterns and markers of a certain version of what it looks like to go to school in the US, but it's not everybody's version of what it looks like to go to school in the US. So no, we don't have a science that can really apply if equity is the framework. We have some indications, we have some directions, we have some ideas from the science that we have. And we also have a pretty good idea of the kind of science that we would need if we wanted to put equity first, but that certainly is not what's being brought to bear at the moment. And I wanna be clear that that's not because researchers aren't doing a good job of reaching out to diverse populations and blah, blah, blah. A lot of the science in quotation marks that's informing the science of reading movement is more than 20 years old. In fact, a good chunk of it is more than 30 years old. I just went through with a colleague and looked at the references that are included in a bunch of the different tools that have been floated out there to evaluate curriculum. And it's, you know, on the encouraging side, there certainly are references from the last 5 and 10 years, but the ones that show up the most are really studies, small ones, from the late 70s and early 80s. So, you know, about as old as I am. And about a world and about a set of schools that could be studied at that point, in that time. And so we really are skewed as a research field, we're always working to be less skewed than we are. But we're talking about research that was developed a really long time ago. And there's certainly, I mean, you know, someone's going to immediately jump down my Twitter with like, but what about this study? Or what about this study? There certainly could be examples. There certainly are examples of studies that have tried to do a better job of demonstrating some kind of demographic diversity and investigating urban schools and investigating schools that don't have the bandwidth to participate in research, but particularly with retrospective studies where we just look at the data that they already had. But the recommendations for practice and the way that we make those practices happen, we don't have that for all different kinds of schools and all different kinds of settings and communities. We don't have what should the schedule be for every single different school. We don't have what should the teacher professional development be for all of the different schools. And we certainly don't have the box. So, you know, as you were talking early in the show about this sort of upside down accountability that we have, like Jonathan Kozol saying that you'd hold an 8-year-old accountable before you would hold the creator of a, the publisher of a curriculum or the creator of that curriculum accountable. Or in this case, maybe before you would hold people at the State Department of Education accountable. And we also have a strange kind of, we're used to thinking about policy as something that starts at the state level and trickles down. But this current science of reading policy in Connecticut has been dramatically reshaped by the State Department of Education. The law that was written could have been rolled out completely differently than it was. And so in this situation, we have a State Department of Education that has really narrowed and really incomprehensibly twisted what was written into law by the legislators. So when I've talked to legislators or I've talked with colleagues who are talking with their local representatives about how upset they are about the choices they've been given, about the disregard of their progress, about the disregard of their time, especially folks that are being forced into, in order to get money from the state to do this, you have to agree to do 50 something hours of professional development webinars, and they're such poor quality and they're undifferentiated. To your point about, do we know what teachers need? Teachers need different things depending on what they know and have. And that isn't being met in any way, shape, or form. We do have a science for professional development. It's being totally ignored. So following the money has been something that is perplexing to me, because when I look at the choices that the State Department has allowed, and I look at the scores that different programs received in their rating process, and I, you know, those are not public, but you have worked with folks that have done freedom of information requests for their own scores or for all the scores, and it really just doesn't add up. So there's no way that the state can say we have chosen the best quality programs, because there's clearly a different logic in place when their own numbers don't add up. Programs with really high ratings are not selected. Programs with low ratings are selected. Programs with really low ratings were rated again and then selected. So the idea.
Well, maybe we should follow the money.
Right.
It's hard to do, but maybe I'll AFT and TEA union lobbyists, I mean, they have lawyers and stuff. They might want to follow this to go back to our policymakers and our legislators and say, hey, let's talk about. So that's just something to think about in that piece. And for me, it's so I'm in my, we want to say, 40th year doing this stuff. So yes, I have seen these reading wars, and I'll just throw in a good book many years ago. Let me see if it pops up for us. I don't know, maybe not. But Rachel, Rona Flippo wrote a book.
Oh yeah,
that was what the experts agree on. And yep. She wrote, that was a very popular book. It looked at all of the different sides. Mm-hmm. It's got to be 20 or 30 years old at this point, probably about the time that research you and I are talking about coming out. You know, it really, it isn't new. There's no new science. It was going out a lot, you know, coming out of the University of Oregon, for one of example, pushing some of this stuff back then. Yeah. That was the old Distar House. So just to go back when we've been around long enough. And I'm not critical of things. No. I agree with Rona. Are we really? I don't know any reading. So when they looked at, they did the transactional view. That's Louise Rosenblatt. Mm-hmm. They did Ken Goodman, did Marilyn Adams, who did all the initial framework for phonics and looked at the National Reading Panel report and all that. And she kept sending them a list and saying, tell me what would make it easy to do to read. Tell me what would make it hard. And she did that over several years. This is her dissertation. And it came down to 28 common things. Guess what? Ken Goodman agreed that phonics is important.
Of course he did. Oh, anybody that's read his articles wouldn't be surprised by that.
I'm just like, you know, all of these things, they had so much agreement. And I would call that agreement the science. I'm not certain where it is right now in that sense, because I don't have any of my teachers saying they don't do phonics, they don't do phonemic awareness. I might argue they do too much phonemic awareness. You know, when do we?
Yeah, get, no, we have some pretty good evidence of that.
Word families, and when did we get to that? Do we ever get when Bro was on with us last time? Her, she sees a lot of, you know, strength in the science of reading, but she also says, "Where's the vocabulary? Where's the comprehension? Where's the diverse books? Where's the?" So she's raising a lot of questions. And I think she's in Texas today, you know, somehow trying to do this balance. But I want to come back to, because there's this piece is, because I would argue that Connecticut has never done right by Black and Brown and special education children, not in 30 years, not in 50, in 170 years. I would argue we have never done that. We burnt Prudence Crandall School down to the ground because she decided to educate Black girls. I mean, we've got a history, we've got Black laws keeping Black children from school. We have so many things in the state. We have history that's so steep. Maybe those, when you said those, that mentality of this white male, whatever it is, we don't look at the history. So I just have not seen a State Department of Education or a governor or a legislature calling you out, Black and Latino caucus in Connecticut. It's time to fight for real equity in our schools. But anyway, coming back, I wanted to get, because I'm taking away from your time.
No, I think actually, if you don't mind, if I can pick up on something, I think that's important. My understanding is that this particular science of reading law has been heavily supported by the Black and Puerto Rican caucus. And I think that there is a sense among legislators that this was their moral duty to pass a law like this, to contain and restrain teachers, to make them do the right thing, and to give them the materials that they need to do it. And there's two sad things about that. One of them is that it's not. And we could have known that just by looking at the policy construction in general, how like support and develop policies have much better outcomes than measure and sort policies, which is sort of what this one is. It's really an accountability policy that leads to privatizing. It's sort of making the core functions of schooling and abdicating them and giving them to outside private entities instead of saying, hey, school and community or town, come up with a curriculum, which is in our law right now. Like the town has the ability, the local authority has the ability to come up with the curriculum. But at the moment, we're not allowed to anymore. You have to select a set of materials and you have to follow those materials. So even if you wanted to kind of plug them in to what you had, your idea for curriculum that fit your community and fit your goals, that would be out of compliance. Now, there's a lot of districts around here that are doing some high quality, quiet disobedience. And it's, watch the news the next 2-3 weeks. The State Department's going to do a victory lap claiming that the schools that adopted their new programs have great DIBL scores. And they're going to say that like the teachers are so happy and that nobody has to plan anymore. And so it's all wonderful and perfect. And I think you're absolutely right, though. All we have to do is wait 4 to 6 years to find out that it doesn't actually pan out that way. And some places are in a better place if they had nothing going and for literacy or for professional development. Getting something is so much better than nothing. But that doesn't mean that folks that had something something good were, you know, aren't being harmed and held back by this set of policies. So Black and Puerto Rican caucus, I think, thought they were doing this work with this bill. And I do believe that there were ways that the bill could have been implemented that would have been closer to fine, to borrow a phrase from the Indigo Girls. I think there are structural problems with the bill, just as a policy instrument, there are structural problems. But the idea and the support for it could have been implemented in a way that foregrounded equity, and it just absolutely wasn't. It just decidedly wasn't. It just on purpose, it seems like, wasn't.
I'm certain their heart was in this, but I'm going to borrow an old, so I'm an old civil rights activist. I'm going to borrow a phrase, keep your eyes on the prize. And if you have a state that is okay, says it's not responsible for giving every child in our state an equitable and high quality education, if that's your state, then your state is a state that should be ashamed. Yep. And if our State Department of Education isn't fighting every day with those legislators in Hartford saying, when are you going to give us equity? When do Black and brown children in their schools have the extra school psychologists, the counselors, the reading specialists, the special, Bridgeport has half of the special education teachers they're supposed to have. When do we come in to their rescue? When does a State Department come in and say to the city of Hartford, you can't lay off 364 of your staff because that new program we gave you now will surely fail because you won't have the teachers and the staff to make it work, even if it was the best over there. Right. So my plea for my brothers and sisters in the Black and Latino caucus is keep your eye on the prize and realize that while we may have lost that CJEP case, the first decision CJEP case, the Supreme Court admitted that Black and brown and special education children receive a low quality and unequitable education. And for me, that's the prize has to be to overturn that. So I hope, and you know, when I retire next year, you know, I'm going to be in the State Department. I'm going to be at every education meeting. I don't have to go to my 45 department meetings a semester and my class and do all the things. I'm going to be the thorn in their side that reminds them every day that your eye's not on the prize. But anyway, I want to get back to, and this is something I wonder if the public understands that structural racism has these distractions, you know, that says we're doing the right thing, but really isn't. So is the science of reading and these curriculum decisions now, are they distractions? And I really, and if they're distractions, what are they distractions from? Are they trying to keep me off, you know, I like chocolate ice cream. That one up by UConn over there, that little gal place that makes the fresh ice cream, I can't resist, I can't pass by. But I'm saying, are they trying to keep my eye off the ice cream? So I do believe things are purposeful and intentional. So if this is a distraction, right? What is it distracting us from?
Equity is a good header for the column of things that it's distracting us from. And I think it really depends. Each district could probably tell you, and it would be different. Each district could probably tell you, what have you let go because you've had to attend so strongly to a flawed and failed State Department implementation of this law? And that might be, what could you have done with the 52 hours that 10 of your most highly trained reading professionals had to spend in a low-level introduction to concepts that they have definitely known because they definitely already passed the foundations of reading test. So thanks for that. What could you have done with the hours that you spent writing a waiver that the State Department didn't even look at? They outsourced that. They had no comment about that. They hadn't seen most of what the districts included. And so most of them didn't get any feedback. And when they did, it wasn't meaningful feedback. So what did you take? What ball did you take your eye off of? And I can think of districts that had to take their eye off of balls related to student health and wellness, balls related to staffing equity across schools and across districts. I know that people have had to take their eye off the ball in terms of making sure that they had diverse voices and representation in the texts and the stories, the activities and the topics that they're covering, because they weren't allowed to make those choices anymore. The state made it for them. And the state made it for them in the face of clear evidence that the programs that they chose were culturally destructive. That didn't matter.
Did you just say culturally destructive?
Yes.
That's the term.
Yeah, that's the term that comes right from the culturally responsive scorecard that NYU has developed to look at different curricular materials. They have one for English language arts. They have one for STEM. And, you know, the far end of the spectrum on that rubric, you know, goes from culturally responsive or sustaining to sort of culturally neutral. But the far end is culturally destructive. Like, if you put these stories and these voices in front of kids day after day, eventually it's going to erode their sense of self. It's going to erode their ideas about other people. It's giving them negative stereotypes and or no stereotypes about people who are different from them. And two other programs that the state has said it are the science of reading meet that criteria for culturally destructive, but they're still on our list. And they're not just on our list. So 11 states have a list of curricular programs that you've got to buy. And these two programs are the ones that are the most commonly selected. Everything else on the list of different states, and Colorado has like 30 something options. Other states have many fewer options. But everything else on the list, if you compare states, states are choosing completely different things except for these two. And this is a follow the money thing, because it's the two that we've seen in the game forever that were a huge part of Reading First. But forget that. They were a huge part of the 70s and the 60s and the 50s and the 40s. Like, these are the two big players. We're talking about McGraw-Hill and Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. They, under different names, have been a huge part of the story of education publishing in the U.S. forever. And they are still a huge part of the story, even when people say that they're choosing new, science-informed, like, great, new, silver bullety things. Every state is still choosing them. And because they're ready, because they're coordinated, because they're shiny, because they have the capacity to not have all their stuff on back order, because they can happily send you free samples, these are the ones that are getting chosen the most. So it's not just that they're on every list. They're actually ending up in every class, in more classrooms than the other things on the list, which we could talk about them too, but we know that these are not what the folks in the Black and Puerto Rican caucus were probably going for when they supported this law. We know that they're not what science of reading advocates were going for when they advocated for the science of reading. And yet they are the ones that are consistently showing up and getting in to classrooms under science of reading policies. So really, these policies end up being a shell for something other than the science of reading.
Something other. And so this is where I will implore my brothers and sisters in the Black and Latino caucus, if two of these programs are rated as culturally destructive to Black and brown children in the state of Connecticut, in the nation, and not just to Black and brown, because if you don't give me a culturally relevant curriculum, then also the white children are soaking up the very stereotypes that have bedded centuries of racism in them. Brothers and sisters, I got another thing to testify at the State Department of Education. Rachel, you're going to send me the name of those two programs. Send me the NYU rubric, because I'm let's go there, because now I know, right? I do my lecture on Monday in class. Mm-hmm. But coming back to this notion of what's, you know, it's, and I always come back to the equity, but equity is just another name for what's just and moral, yes. What's mm-hmm. right. So mm-hmm. so we all of us in literacy know, we know about Dr. Rudine Sims Bishop's mirrors and windows and sliding doors. And for the public, it's really simple. You do better when you read things and you see yourself in the books. Those are the mirrors. She said Black children, she worked with adolescent Black children, and saw that their scores were higher when they did that. But she argues that those windows and those sliding doors, so the windows are where I see others. And she wants you to see positive images of all people in those. So if I'm a white child and I see positive images, I'll give you an example, Roberto Clemente. I love the Roberto mm-hmm. Clemente story, because there are not many athletes that die bringing food and medical supplies to earthquake victims, flying in the plane himself to make sure they got distributed to the right people. Mm-hmm. Yes, he was a great baseball player, but so many of the culturally relevant stories, like when Burrow was with us, Dr. Burrow Bailey, she says, mm-hmm. Jesse, do you know this person? Do you know that person? You know this? It doesn't matter whether they're Black, Jesse, you should know the character of them. And in terms of the character of them. So the idea that we're not seeing, children are not seeing mirrors. Mm-hmm. We're not seeing windows. So I can see, I should be able to see that, you know, in the arms, we just did, I'm trying to think, Shaha Radars, a great Iraqi agriculture, I mean, architect. And we're reading her book with a couple of Islamic girls and other girls. And their smiles are lighting up. Oh, that's Baghdad. Oh, isn't that where the greatest library was? There's so many connections. But when you have a rich and diverse curriculum, and the other girls in that group are sitting back and saying, wow, she's really great. I love that when the men told her to dress like men when they come to the meeting so you could be more professional. So she said, I'm putting on the red boa. I'm wearing my heels. I'm wearing my hat. And I'm not changing a thing about me. But I'm just saying that kind of concept, this is what we're missing. Our children are missing the real story of Ruby Bridges, the real story of Dr. King, the real story of Roberto Clemente, the real story of Cesar Chavez, the real story of the women's suffrage movement. There's so many of this stuff. So it's almost like, is my race to be literate? Maybe this is my question. Let's say we made everyone able to read. But we know there's a term in literacy called illiteracy.
Right.
And illiteracy is where I could read, but I choose not to read.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm getting back in the, I'd like to know, is there a best case scenario? Because you had mentioned this question to me, and I said, what is the best case scenario? Because I'm good at critiquing and criticizing. But my friends and colleagues said, well, now give us what the best case scenario is. Can you help us out? What would be a best case scenario for literacy in Connecticut?
Yeah, I think we have to look out a little bit beyond next year in order to get to a good case scenario. But I think that there are things that people can do that sort of maintain their integrity in this moment where they're really being asked to compromise it. The story, the choice in front of district leaders right now is buy into, at great cost to your district, buy into something that you know is not the best of the best, at a time when it may or may not be in the best interest of your district to make this kind of a change, or risk being out of compliance with the state. And depending on whether you've got the support of your board, whether you've got a huge budget deficit, whether you need a lot of additional state funding in order to make things happen, you are more or less in a position to say, you know what, come for me, I'm not doing this. I think probably the best case scenario is to really follow the spirit of the law, what I think lawmakers were looking and asking for, which is, can we have a high level of accountability for leaders saying, we know that our schools have high quality materials, and we know that our teachers have high quality professional learning opportunities throughout the year. And if you can't say yes, absolutely, with 100% certainty, then you have work to do, but that work is your work, and your work is not the same work as a district right next to you, and their work is not the same work as a district right next to them. So I think the idea was, let's sort of create a baseline, a minimum level of answer to that question that feels better than actually we have no idea. And that is absolutely the truth of some districts have not had a change in reading curriculum in 30 years. Some districts have not had literacy professional development in so many years, and that isn't okay. And a law could invite them to consider and to reflect on with their colleagues and peers across districts, what do we need to be paying attention to? Do our teachers have what they need to do a good job for every student that we have? Not just to do a good job the way we used to 30 years ago, but to do a good job with the students that they have in front of them. That's a great question to be asking. And the state should be getting in line saying, how do we support you in asking and answering that question? It's not about the materials. The state is lining up to give people tools to rate materials. Listen, materials have nothing to do with it. That doesn't mean there's not good and bad materials. It means materials have nothing to do with it when you don't have the infrastructure in place to implement materials in a way that's faithful. So if teachers don't have security in their contracts, if teachers think they're getting laid off every 10 seconds, if teachers don't have enough of any set of materials in science and social studies, in reading, in math, they don't have enough for the kids in their class. If teachers don't have the support of coaches or instructional leaders in the building that can help them reflect on what they're doing and make it better all the time, if they don't have a schedule that even allows them to implement this fancy new program that we just bought them, if they don't have Chromebooks that work so that they can do this fancy new program, which, by the way, is all virtual. And so the next thing will be we've got to invest more in the computers and less in the people, continue this trend of investing more in the stuff and less in the humans so that
we know
that we can do what we said we were going to do.
And the computer monies, just in case, K-12 districts and the State Department, they already know. And I'll let you, the computer money's gone. So yeah. That $190 billion is gone. So they better already give another $100 billion. I'm very much aware that we're talking about a $1 billion surplus again. So I see areas to make some improvements right now. Let's give another $100 billion. If you really value those devices with our students, then you should be supporting them, upkeeping them. You should also be, it's unacceptable to be talking about thousands of teacher layoffs.
Yep.
In primarily poor districts. And so I wanted to come back to something that you said before, and you kind of distinguished with SOR. You kind of talked about the science, and then you said there's like this other thing. There's this. So what I think they do well, and I don't know if it's the publishers, but these people who somehow are podcast star, who has never been a teacher, never been a reading teacher, but a mother, followed by millions. I'm told time and time again to watch the podcast. I have watched the podcast. It's sort of like, you know, if I want to learn about heart surgery, I shouldn't be watching the podcast about somebody that had heart surgery. I should be following, you know, I want to know who the doctor was. I want to know that they followed best practice, that kind of stuff. But tell me about, so let's is there a sort of social media campaign that pushes an imperfect science of reading?
Yes and no. I think there used to be. I think it's become diffused. There's been so much infighting and so much kind of backtreading. What do you call that? Backtracking from some folks. Right. It used to be much more clear and united, and you could find, you know, the Facebook groups and the people to follow on Twitter and on Instagram and things like that. Right when when Sold a Story first came out, and probably for a good 18, 24 months after. But now folks in those groups either made good on their promise to care about research and have read more of the research, and so they are complicating their positions. They might be renaming something so they don't have to admit that they fought against something that was actually good. Or they might be saying, well, we didn't have this evidence, but now we have this evidence and I am going to follow the evidence, sort of as, you know, as you mentioned that Diane Ravitch would do. And that is sort of the pretense of integrity there. Might be right, might be wrong, who knows, it doesn't matter. But I think there used to be a big major force, and it was pretty clearly anti-teacher, although nobody would admit that. Because it doesn't have to be anti-teacher in the minds and hearts of the people who are repeating these talking points over and over again. It's anti-teacher in the outcome. So when you say teachers don't know how to teach reading, but it's not their fault, the outcome of that is teachers will not be allowed to make decisions. And they will more often be replaced by computers. So it's an anti-teacher thing to say, even if you don't like, you know, people on social media are the first to say. I think probably the most common quote related to the science of reading on social media is, no one is saying that. Because someone will say a statement and they'll get attacked for saying it, but they'll get attacked for saying something they didn't mean. And just because you didn't mean it doesn't mean it doesn't have that impact. And I think folks are entering an arena that they hadn't participated in much before, so they don't know how different ideas resonate or what they're connected to or what other people might understand when they say these certain things. But also, the beauty of the science of reading movement is it got a whole lot of energy and momentum by being confusing, by getting everybody in here saying, like, you know, everybody has a reason that their hackles are up, because it is confusing on purpose, and things are done to keep it that way. And there are certainly groups, I think the Reading League has made a big deal out of trying to say, like, no, here is the definition. Nobody has to follow that. And a lot of people don't, but that. And now they've come out with a curriculum rating tool and with ratings of different programs. And they are saying some of these programs that are out there under the banner of the science of reading, we don't actually think that they are. And of course, there are ways you can make them that way. But that means that you have to trust your teachers to make good decisions. There isn't a program on the market that has everything you need. There isn't one. And P.S., this law was supposed to be pre-K to five, but there wasn't anything for pre-K, so they just ignored that. There's nothing on the market that is science of reading aligned for pre-K. We just don't have it. So we just like conveniently ignore it. And this is the problem with this policy in general. It promised something so
we doesn't ignore exist. Things. There's good and bad. It reminds me of something. So that David Pearson, who is really, you know, we used to call him Mr. Comprehension. So he's an International Literacy Association, Hall of Fame. You know, I think David is 80 years old and extremely active and very critical of what's going on right now. Yeah. But David at a session once said to us, the good news is comprehension matters now. He said, the bad news is comprehension matters now. and it, like, it took us a minute to do. And he's saying, well, you know, some of the matters is not the comprehension that we would advocate for. And and as I said, some of the program and policies we were talking about, that was the essence of his presentation. Sure. And that point, saying we're pushing something that won't improve comprehension. Right. Will be a literal version of comprehension that will leave our children behind. And I remember that. So I think we're probably at that. And it brings me back to a chapter that I'm most proud of that I wrote with Dr. Prochet and Dr. Pensper. Those are my special ed colleagues. And we wrote a chapter about balanced literacy, a balanced framework for literacy. And and I remember at the end of that, you know, it was at the height of NCLB. And I remember they really got mad at me because I said, this is the most expensive failing education reform in the history of public education. We can't put that in there. And I said, well, then I don't want to be a part of the chapter, but we're in there. And the publisher said, okay. They were like, they didn't notice. They don't really read it over there. Oh. But that's fine. We're very proud of it now. But when we did, when I share that, I still share that chapter. And really it comes down to, and it's what you were saying to me, what you were saying to us here, that the heart of a literacy curriculum that works has to be the teacher, has to be a teacher that's valued, a teacher that's supported. And and at the heart in that chapter that I wrote, what really said, you don't need to go, parents don't need to call SBAC, or at the time it was, I forget, NAEP. You don't need to call them. You never have a career conference with them. The person that knows the most about your child's literacy is their teacher. And that's why you have parent conferences. That's why you have access to them. So I think if while I think, yes, the good news is the science of reading made us talk about reading again. One of the districts that I have a nice relationship got rid of their reading teachers for a while. And all of a sudden, the science of reading came back and we have reading teachers again, which is good. You know, like good. I don't know. So there is there's something to David Pearson's and your piece in that piece. But really, I'd like to think about that 5 years, 10 years down the road, the data's going to come back.
Right.
How do we make the teacher, and not only the teacher, the student, because we're not talking to our children. We're not talking to them. What are these curriculums doing to them?
Right.
How do we're not talking to Black and brown children who are using those two programs that are culturally destructive. We're not interviewing them and saying, how does that make you feel as a proud young Black man or a proud, proud young Black girl? How does it make you feel? We're not asking them. We don't talk to the children ever.
No.
So I'm thinking about what would a curriculum that honors teachers and children in 5 years' time, a literacy one, and I know it's connected to everything else, I mean, but what would that look like?
I think about, I don't want to give too simple an answer to this, but I actually think it is pretty simple. I think two words, alignment. It is aligned with the values of that community. In every way, that you're not being asked to compromise your integrity to teach some of the lessons. You're not like, oh, well, we'll skip this unit where they say terrible things about Native Americans. That's fine. We'll just go to the next unit because the people that wrote this and stuck that in there, we'll just pretend that they didn't mean it and we'll keep going. We'll still use materials that were developed in a way that doesn't honor all people. We'll think that's fine because who knows? So it has to be in alignment with the values of the community. And that includes the children. And so children, even little children, need to be part of conversations about new curriculum, and they need to be part of pilots of new curriculum. If this were really about science of reading, there would be a scientific rollout. People would pilot things, they would see how it went, they would make some comparisons, they would keep going. This is not that. This is we're going to fake some numbers, we're going to tell you what your choices are, and then we're going to tell you you have to make one of the choices whether your current program is better than these or not. So we need to have alignment, and then we also have to have coherence. And coherence means across all the content areas. We can't be studying reading and writing in one way and then studying these other things in another way. And also coherence with the community. We can't be studying reading and writing only at school. It has to have some kind of relationship and connection to the ways literacy exists outside of school. Otherwise, there's no reason to learn it. And otherwise, we don't get any of the incidental practice, any of the homeschool connection, any of all of these things that we know are important when we study upper middle class kids, when there's a total transfer between the way that people use language and literacy at home and at school. It's super, super familiar. But what if you're making a couple steps of a leap because the ways of using language and literacy vary? Maybe you're using a different language. Maybe you have different literacy practices. What about students that are not are crossing a border, crossing a boundary between home and school every time? We have to have coherence for them too. They deserve it because their peers have it, and their peers have an easier time accessing and practicing and demonstrating their proficiency because they don't have to cross the border at all. Same, no problem. So coherence for the kids, coherence, for the teachers.
Alignment, real science. It's funny. Wasn't that what we had with Reading First? I mean, in Reading First, in NCOB, they added a science component because the old Elementary and Secondary Act required it. We don't require it anymore, but it asked, is this program effective?
Right.
And so we had 6 years, $6 billion, and the schools got all the tools, all the bells and whistles.
Yeah.
And strangely enough, I mean, at the end of the George Bush administration, he kept it silent. That's why Diane Ravitch left. They weren't sharing. The data came in that said at every single grade from K to three, children lost comprehension. Yes, they could decode maybe well, or they might be identifying phonemes, but they never seemed to. My argument would be, well, maybe they never got to the vocabulary and comprehension. Maybe
they never got
to real stories or real novels. Right. I'm not certain in that sense, but that is that the data was in there. The science was in there. And maybe that should be a policy request for us in Connecticut.
Yes.
That there should be a science evaluations. And with NCOB's Reading First, it had to be an outside entity that had no connection to financial gains.
Right.
And they were it was the most rigorous educational study in the history of literacy in the United States of America. And that's why we don't have Reading First schools. And I would go back and say some of those schools were doing some things well. You know, but you know, what did we learn to dismiss it? That's what we did. So, but
Reading First is a perfect example because they had the same thing we're seeing now, which is people that had nothing experience the stabilize and lift because they're getting something for the first time, and that's going to happen, and that's good for them, or it's fine for them for now. That's a really good place to start. It's not a good place to continue from. I mean, it's not a good taste to continue in. Like, begin there, yes. And then we've got to build your teachers. We have to build the professionals in the building that use the stuff. The stuff is not going to save us. It's probably eventually, after the initial lift, it's going to get in our way. And so if we don't have the wisdom and the knowledge to use it well, it's just going to get in our way. And it's going to get in our way in super predictable ways. We know what they are. They're culturally destructive. We know that we're going to have to follow the data that spits out of the computer. And we know that those tests are biased. So that we know that, we come in knowing that, and we're going to keep using them as if the computer knows more than the teacher.
Well, we've come to an end for an hour. We could have done another hour. Thank you, Rachel. Thank you.
And be for having me.
As I got another rhyme, another rhythm for y'all to listen. I'm never quitting on my mission. I'm going to roll with what I'm giving. Got some ambition, this new addition, filling positions. Looking at the void in myself and feeling what's missing. Better watch the way you're going. Better go in the right direction. In the moment, you're stressing, but you're going to be counting blessings. And I know that for certain. Keep on working, open curtains. Haters swerving because they ain't ready for your final version.